This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Yeah, welcome to the Christian War Room, and we are looking at, we are back on evolution, the subject of evolution. So we had a bit of a break talking about bad teachers and people coming up with all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, evangelicals leaving the fold, leaving the truth, leaving the Word of God, and going on a different path and drawing a lot of people behind them. It's really shocking what you see out there in this world. Okay, I want to talk about the theory of evolution. I made many, many points why it's important to try to get your head around it. Just to reiterate, I'm not an academic. I am, but not in this field. You know? I'm an educator, and I've done my academic credentials in education. I'm an engineer. I'm an electronics engineer with an emphasis on RF electronics. I've been through the world of academia. I've been through the world of education. I've seen a lot. I've been around for many years, so that's really all to my credentials. But I'm not, the expert of all experts. Nevertheless, there's a certain amount of common sense you can apply to this, and when you, if you can add up and you know basic math and you know that 1 + 1 = 1, and basically that's what some people try and make you believe, that 1 + 1 = 1. 1 × 1 = 1, that's what I wanted to say. 1 × 1 = 1, 2 × 2 = 4, and so on. If you know this, you can very often draw conclusions to the stuff you can see around yourself. And what you will find is that the theory of evolution stands on very shaky ground and doesn't really stand up against any scrutiny. Scrutiny is not allowed. You start scrutinizing it. People get very nervous about it. They call you a bigot or a religious fanatic or something like that. But it's up to you, you know, and this is basically what I try to point out with this talk. So it's 100 points of evolution. We did cover points 48 and 49. I think there's a bit of repetition as well from what I've seen so far. The way I've done is I just sat down one day and I made some notes and I thought, what do I know about the Earth around me? What do I see within the cosmos, you know, or space? What can I understand with the limited understanding I have? And what are the conclusions I come to, you know, stuff I've heard? And it becomes more and more obvious that the theory of evolution just cannot stand. And partly it's down to lack of evidence. If you follow the logical conclusion of what they say should have happened, it's not there. It doesn't make sense. And with that, you can pretty much, take this theory and throw it overboard and forget about it. And it's just a fantasy some secular scientists, some atheists come up with in order to reinforce their position. And very often it's not even a position. They are trying to fight against something which they hate, they very intensely dislike. And that is the notion that there is a God out there. Okay. Let's look at number 50 in our talk on 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. Number 50 is the perfect condition for life here on Earth. It's interesting as well. It's sort of in the early days, when you go back in the 50s and 60s, and we didn't really know what was going on. People thought that, you know, there was life on Mars. And that is pretty much the consequence from the theory of evolution anyway. So if you assume that is okay, yeah, then the universe should just aim to produce life. And we should have various life forms on different planets as well. And we don't find them. We don't find anything on Venus. We don't find anything on Mars because the conditions are just not right. Yeah, any of the other planets, the same thing. So they now go down, okay. They haven't got like little Martians or little men running around. So they look for microbes. And even them, they don't seem to find. And whatever they find, it can be subject to discussion of whether they really find fossilized microbes or not. There's one meteor and then some scientist came up and says, oh, these are microbes. When you look at what they found, it could just be formation of whatever, you know, of mineral. Formation of some sort or another, which just happens to look like it could be organic life, but there's no evidence, there's nothing there. Okay, number 50, perfect conditions for life here on Earth. We've got the rotation of the Earth, which is just right. If it went any slower, it would be a problem. If it went any faster, it would be a problem. We would have massive winds here on Earth, which would make life very difficult. We've got water as well. Yeah, water, essential for life. And again, look around you. I think you are pretty much made up of 90-odd% of water. Yeah, so if you don't hydrate your body, there's not much left over after some time. Again, very easy way to find out. Go to a crematorium and see what's left over of a human body. And it's normally about half a kilo. It's about a pound or a couple of pounds, maybe 4 or 5 pounds of material. That includes the material for the coffin as well and everything else after the human body's been burned up. And the rest is just vapor, water, you know, being burned out of the body. So that's, you know, quite a strange thought to think of it, that most of it, most of your body is just water. Yeah. Again, when you look around you, it's pretty much the same thing. There's just some chemical reactions. You've got carbon, which is taken from the atmosphere, which gets into wood and plant life. And if you take the element of life, if you, for example, would say, right, or if, let's say God would say, which he doesn't, okay, he will at the end, you know, the earth will be destroyed after the last rebellion, where the elements will melt, where, okay, that's what we have in Peter, what Peter tells us in the Bible. But if God said, right, that's it, no more life, and the force of life was withdrawn, no more life possible, within a very short time, all we would have is a planet that looks pretty much like the moon or like Mars, where all you have is just lots and lots of dust and minerals and stuff like that, but nothing else. So it's the life force is quite amazing of what it does. And again, everything is based on water, pretty much. The distance from the sun is just about right to get the temperatures we need for the life as we know it. The presence of the moon is very important as well. If it weren't for the moon, the Earth would rotate a lot faster. And so we need the moon around the Earth in order to make it work. We've got a diversity of food as well. So again, very, very important. So we can get all the minerals and everything we need to build up our body from the food that is around us. Yeah. So that's 50. So we've got perfect conditions for life on Earth. And we don't have this anywhere else from what we can tell with the knowledge we've got today. Okay, number 51 is a thing as well. In evolution, we are told it's survival of the fittest. And yet we've got a lot of codependence between different animals. And certain animals will almost not be able to survive without this codependence which is there. One example may be the simple domesticated sheep. Sheep requires a shepherd. Yeah? They're very vulnerable without a shepherd. And that suggests that, you know, man and sheep have been around from day one, which from a biblical point of view is not a problem. Yeah? Man and sheep have been around from day one. And we can read this in the Bible. Evolutionists, obviously, they've got a different idea. They say, oh, common ancestor, goat, sheep, something like that. And they got domesticated and became very stupid and dependent. And so that's the reason why we've got sheep today. I'm not going to go too much into this because it would take me ages. But I would recommend to you to, if you can read up on sheep, like a synopsis of the relationship between a shepherd and a sheep and all the stuff which has to be done for sheep to try and keep them safe. And some of the stupid things sheep do, getting themselves into a lot of trouble. When you go through all this stuff, you kind of can see very much how this relationship works. And on the other side, there's an image as well between man and God that we are considered to be like sheep, you know, not really getting it and running away and doing stupid things. And we really depend on the shepherd to straighten out our lives. And I tell you one thing, I totally agree with that. Yeah. When I look at my life, I used to think when I was young and maybe as a young Christian as well, that I'm okay. You know, I can sort it all out. The older I get, the more I realize that I can't sort it all out and that I'm not okay. And I totally depend on my God. I totally and utterly depend on God. Even in simple things, you know, just to get my life together, make sure I'm okay. It's hard. Life is hard. It's not easy. And it's good if you've got God to help you, you know, guide you, lead you, send you support and assistance to try, just try and make it. I mean, we're living in a horrible world. And this is one thing as well where I think how lovely, you know, how great it's going to be to go to paradise, to live in just a perfect environment where everything is just right, where you don't have to chase around for the dentist or the health service, you know, the doctor. You don't have to chase around for money, pay the bills and, you know, be done in by corporations, be done in by thieves and stuff like that. You don't have to worry about this, no vet bills or anything like that. You're just, everything is right, everything is perfect. God has made everything perfect. And you just live there, you enjoy whatever God has given, and it's going to be the utmost. And I know as well, when I look at creation, and it sometimes bamboozles me, when I look at the diversity of stuff that see on the planet, even in this fallen state of this planet, how marvelous it is. And again, all I want to do is just encourage you. You know, sometimes you can see a whole universe on a little square inch in your garden. You know, if you take the time to just look at this, look at the shape of the plants which are there, you know, the flowers, the plants, even the weeds. Yeah, we don't like them, we hate them, but some of them, they've got marvelous, you know, flowers and things like that. And you know, the number of animals. Take a water drop, put it on a microscope, and you see another universe just inside this water drop. And it is fascinating when you see all this stuff. Really, really fascinating. But how much more is it going to be when you go to the place God has prepared for us? You know, a paradise, perfect place. You know, just perfect, just right, nothing wrong. No disease, no pain, no nothing. Okay. Creation of life. This is number 52 we are now on. There was an experiment which was done in the 50s, and obviously evolution, they always still think, you know, they're right, and that's the only way it's been done. And they've got all the answers and peer-reviewed papers, and they must be right because the colleagues say it's right. And they came up with this experiment where they tried to put some amino acids together, which make up DNA, to get, you know, this soup, which they're all talking about, you know, get some lightning strikes and get life started. And they couldn't get them together. Nothing worked. You know, the environment which was necessary to spark life would be toxic enough to kill it at the same time. And nothing came out of it. Yeah? So they pretty much abandoned. They tried and tried and tried because it was very important for the theory of evolution to just kick off life and this life force which is there, but they couldn't do it. Yeah? With all the experiments, they abandoned it. It was sometime the 50s and 60s. It was abandoned and it's never been picked up. And then you've got guys like Richard Dawkins, you know, the grandfather of the theory of evolution, and the biggest fighter and the biggest I don't know, mocker of the Bible and of God. It's interesting as well, when you listen to his talks, the majority of the talk is not, you know, what evolution does and what we have found, and it's not really. And you might think, you know, if this were a wise man, he would just look at the evidence he believes is there and just present it, but he doesn't. All he does is he just takes passages from the Bible, tries to find contradictions, ridicules the Bible, ridicules people who believe the Bible, and makes a big thing out of that and believes, you know, that this is science and that this is great. He's just a very sarcastic, arrogant man. Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. But I cannot see in him a plight for truth. I cannot see in him a drive to find the truth. Yeah, but I see in him something else, which is not very nice. But anyway, it's up to you. I mean, obviously, if you like the guy and you like what he's saying, then you will disagree with me, and that's your prerogative. You can do this. Okay, the creation of life experiment didn't work. Yeah. I mean, even Hawkins, and this is the point I tried to make, he came down and he conceded that life has been spawned by aliens because they cannot find any way how even a simple cell, as I mentioned before, you know, more than half a million, 600,000 genes or DNA strands to produce life doesn't exist, cannot happen by chance, and anybody will tell you that it's not happening, not in this universe, not without a designer, not without God. Okay, then number 53 is the anomaly of water. And how can, you know, be water proof of God? I think it is, actually. And when you look at every element, anything you can see, you've got pretty much three states. One is a solid state, then there's a liquid state, and then there's a gaseous state. Pretty much anything you can see, anything you can touch. So you can vaporize something, you can liquidize something. I'm just looking around me, and I've got a steel lamp, a table lamp, like a desktop lamp. And it's made of, I think it's stainless steel, but I know if I increase the temperature, eventually this steel is going to melt and it becomes a liquid. Needs to be a very high temperature, though. And if I take the temperature higher, the molecules will vibrate so much that it'll vaporize. Yeah? The whole thing is just going to vaporize, turn into a gas. Yeah, and it's pretty much for everything you can see. And then as well, the other thing as well is it makes sense why this is taking place. You've got your nucleus, you've got your proton, your neutrons. Around there, you've got a bunch of electrons, which, go around the nucleus. And the higher the temperature is, the more vibration you've got in this structure. And so eventually it'll turn into a liquid, eventually it'll turn into a gas because the vibration becomes more. And the electrons, they expand and, you know, like every material expands. And so what we find is as we cool it down, material contracts, becomes smaller. As we heat it up, it expands. And you can see this again with train tracks and other bits as well. When you heat something up, it'll just become bigger. Physics experiment used to be, the physics teacher used to get a ring and an iron ball. Yeah, and the iron ball would just fall through the ring. That was pretty much the experiment. So he had like a little chain, thing fell through. Then what he would do is he would lift the ball above the ring and start, get a Bunsen burner and start heating up the ball. And then eventually the ball would expand and it wouldn't fit through the ring anymore. Yeah, and then it would cool down and eventually it would plop through the ring. And so he could prove that everything expands by heating it up and it contracts by cooling down. Right. What about water? Water's got this magic thing. And we find that the water at the bottom of the ocean has got the highest density. And it contracts at 4 degrees centigrade. I'm not sure what it is in Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit, let's have a think. I think 32 degrees is zero. So it's going to be, is it times 2? Roughly 4 degrees, 8, 32. It's about 40 degrees. 40 degrees Fahrenheit. 4 degrees centigrade, and it's got the lowest density. So that means that when you go into the ocean and you go right deep down to the depth or a lake or anywhere, that the water will cool down to about 4 degrees and it'll stay there. And if not, it'll go to the surface, and otherwise it'll go down. Then when you cool it down any further, so you go down to 3 degrees, it starts expanding again. You go down to 2, it expands, 1, it expands, 0, it expands, minus 1, expands even more, and so on. So the colder it gets, the more it expands. And the warmer it gets, the more it expands as well. So you go up to 100 degrees, 100 degrees it starts boiling, then steam is generated, and you get the gaseous form of water. Right. Interesting, I think. I think it's really, really interesting when you look at what is happening with water, the anomaly of water. No element in the universe works like water. They all contract when they get colder and expand when it gets warmer. Water doesn't work like that. It goes the other way around. If it weren't the case, a lake would freeze from the bottom up. Ice wouldn't float on the surface of the sea. Yeah, that's one way to prove that it's actually expanding. And a lot of mechanisms in this world wouldn't work. Where does this anomaly come from? It's a big question. To me, it's a proof of God. To you, maybe not. Yeah, but to me, it's just a proof of God. It's just one way where you can see a designer in his hand. And he said, right, water is a very important element. I need to, the people I built, the majority of them is built up of water and carbon. And of all these elements, so you are just a huge pile of water and carbon and very intelligent structure around you that makes up your body. Obviously, you're much more than just your body. You've got a soul and spirit. It's very, very important to bear this in mind. Okay. So anyway, but anomaly of water. We have got still some time, about 10 minutes left. Number 54 is the rotation of the moon. So all celestial bodies rotate. The moon doesn't, or very slowly. Yeah. Okay. It's very, very interesting. So the moon just rotates once every 14, let me correct this, once every 30 days. So that the same side of the moon is, or the same side of the moon is facing the Earth. Okay, so I was intrigued by this fact. Why is it the case? Why does every other moon just rotate around its own axis, but our moon does it as well, but it does it exactly so that the same side of the moon is visible from the Earth at all times? Nobody really thinks about this stuff. It's quite interesting as well. And I sort of tried to figure it out, and I saw some evolutionists, and they say, oh, it's to do with the tidal pull and so on. And this has, you know, locked in the gravitation, the rotation of the moon with the Earth as it goes around the Earth. And I'm kind of thinking, okay, fair enough, but why doesn't it just rotate a little bit? You know, that maybe the rotation is a bit more than 14 days. Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me, at least. And why isn't it the case that other moons in the universe do the same thing? Yeah. I mean, for example, Jupiter. You've got massive gaseous mass, and you might think, okay, maybe, you know, there's some tidal movements as well of some sort or another, that whatever gravitational impact the moon has got on Jupiter will have an impact on the moon as well, and it'll not turn around. It'll do the same thing as our moon, that it'll just turn around in the same sense. And you might, this is the tidal argument, you know, of tidal movement. And the gravity of Jupiter is going to be a lot stronger than whatever Earth does. But no, they all rotate. They've got their own axis. They rotate around there, and they are not locked, that the surface or one side of the moon is just exposed to Jupiter all the time, and the others aren't. You might make an argument, you know, the moon's around Mars, maybe different, yeah. You know, Mars is just dry. There's no liquid or anything there. There's no gas. So, I don't know, yeah. To me, it's, again, another proof that there was the hand of the great master in there. And that is the hand of God, the hand of the great designer who has designed all this stuff. And who's just pointing with his finger, you know, look at this. This points to God. You know, you better worship him, because he is the one who has done all this stuff. He is the one to whom you owe your very existence. Okay, as we're talking about the sun and the moon, this is point number 55. We've got the distance of the moon. First of all, the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. Yeah. Again, it's just a figure they come up with, 400 times smaller than the sun, how precise it is. Again, we don't know, but that's what we find out. This is what astronomers say. So it's not 401 times, not 420 times, not 458.5 times, but exactly 400 times smaller than the sun. And it's exactly 400 times closer to the Earth than the sun is. And this means when the moon is sitting itself in front of the sun, we get a total solar eclipse, and we can still, and it just pretty much fits on top of one another, very, very precisely, so that we can see the solar corona, yeah, you know, all the solar storms and stuff like that, which is taking place. We can see this when there's a lunar eclipse. Why does it exactly fit? You know, why is it not just covering it up 80%? Why is it not covering it up more than 100%? You know. We don't know. It's just a very interesting thing. And again, to me, it's just like all pointing to our God. You know, he has designed all this stuff. He has designed the universe, and he put like lots of little mathematical secrets in here. And this, I believe, is one of those secrets. The size of the moon compared to the size of the sun, and then the distance of the moon compared to the distance of the sun. That there's this relationship there. And we do have lunar eclipses. It's interesting as well. I've never seen a full total lunar eclipse, but I've heard people who have seen it who were totally taken by the whole thing, and for them it was a bit of an epiphany that they at that point believed in the reality of God. just having seen a lunar eclipse and having seen how precise everything works, you know, how precise all the mechanisms in this universe work. For them, it was a bit of an epiphany. Unfortunately, I mean, I was talking to one, it was a colleague of mine, very interesting guy, a very deep thinker, it's a little bit of a benevolent rogue, but he never made anything with it. He knew there was a God and he knew there is a God, but he never went on the quest to really find him and to go for it. And this is sad. It's very, very sad. Right, what have you got? I think we are almost coming to the end of our talk. We've got 2 minutes left. Number 56. Evolutionists defending evolution. I've got here is 56. And I find I'm sort of going a little bit into the philosophical realm of the whole theory of evolution. If it were the truth, evolution, you don't really need to defend this. And it's interesting as well when you look at the defense. And I've watched a lot of debates with Bill Nye and Ken Ham. Bill Nye, the science guy. And he tries to make science accessible to kids. And his great argument is if we teach kids creationism and we abandon the model of evolution, it is not science. We are telling kids to turn to religion and not to science. Now, the problem is the theory of evolution is not science. It's just faith. It's just a concept. It's an idea which has got very, very poor evidence to try and support this. And it is not the truth from what we can see and from the evidence we have got. And I can't think of any great invention an evolutionist has made because he believed in the theory of evolution. On the contrary, what we find is that as time moves on and we gain more and more knowledge in molecular biology and quantum physics and things like that, we see that there are big problems with the theory of evolution and that it doesn't really work, it doesn't really fit into it. And this is one thing we learn as time goes on. And maybe within if we're still going on 100 years, which I don't believe, but if it were, we would come to a point where we would say, okay, we tried it, didn't work very well, a bit like communism, you know, it was a good idea, but it didn't work very well. So maybe it's time to just forget about it and move on and just to leave it out in the open or come back to a creationist model, yeah, that there's a creator who has created everything. And that is the signature which you can see in the universe rather than a signature of randomness, survival of the fittest and selection. So that signature just isn't there, can't be found. Okay, have I got enough time? I've got 30 seconds. I'm going to put number 57 there. The number of pi, and there's no repeating pattern in the number of pi. Pi, again, is the magic number of 3.14 plus lots and lots and lots of positions. And it's used to calculate a circle. Yeah? And there's no repeating number sequence. And there's a lot of research which has gone into pi, and people don't know why. Yeah, it's just one of those things. Pi is pi. It's got like a really interesting pattern. There's no repetition in it. Lots of people have done their PhDs in it. To me, it's a proof of God. You can find God in mathematics. And I'm not a mathematician, you know, per se, but I have to teach mathematics, apply mathematics within engineering. But the number of pi. Pi is a proof of God. Again, some people might go up the barricades right now, but have a look at this. You know, have a look at, you know, what you see in nature and what is there. Okay, I'm running out of time. And we're going to carry on with this. We are at number 57. Probably pick it up on here. So God bless and bye-bye from Michael here in the Christian War Room.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.